Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression, and over 70 years later, they're still here to help people during difficult times. More information is available at mecu.com. We're going to talk this hour about mixed martial arts, about why this sport, which really isn't that new in some ways. It's been around for a long time. People were crossing the lines, and boxers and wrestlers were fighting in the 19th century here in America, and it goes back way beyond that and before. It goes back to the days when I was a kid, and in some neighborhoods like where I was, they were in back alleys and in basements where all kinds of fights going on where there were no rules and regulations, but people were betting on them all the time. But this is different. It's now taken over from boxing, it seems. It's taken over and grabbed the consciousness of people who enjoy that kind of sport. And the question is why? We're going to talk about that and more with all of our guests this hour. We're joined in studio by Dietrich Mohammed, who's Senior Organizer and Research Associate for the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies, and a mixed martial arts enthusiast, which is probably why he's here and not for the former reason that I just read. Dave, Dave Zirin joins us by phone. He's sports writer and host of Edge of Sports Radio on XM Radio, XM and Sirius Radio. And Dan Leibowitz joins us by phone. He's executive director of Sports and Society. And Dan, Dave, and Dietrich, welcome. Good to have all three of you with us.
Thank you very much.
Good to be on.
Great to be here.
Yeah, and was that last voice Dave?
That was me.
Okay,
what's up?
I was to make sure that I had all the voices straight in my head.
That's right.
At least the ones that I'm listening to on the radio. So you can join us here at 410-319.
410. Man, that took me a second. That was funny.
You can join us here at 410-319-8888. I know a lot of you out there watch mixed martial arts. Talk to us about why or why you might not watch them. You can write to us at steinershow@gmail.com or log on to Facebook at Mark Steiner and give us your thoughts there. And I see a number of you already written in on Facebook about mixed martial arts, and we'll find out why. I'm curious from all your perspectives. Let me just start with an overview here. And Dan Leibowitz, it's always a pleasure to have folks on from Sports and Society. And
thanks enough for that.
It's great to have you here. Talk a bit about why you think this phenomenon has caught on so deeply with the American, and not just the American public, but with people across the globe.
I think that a lot of our society is somewhat caught up in violence, or is sort of the celebration of violence in some ways, and this is the ultimate sport that celebrates violence. And so, you know, for us at the center, where we're working on a number of programs like that teach how to eradicate youth violence or how to address and prevent men's violence against women, this is sort of a topical area for us, because it seems like we're constantly fighting against a culture of that it celebrates violence and sort of sensationalizes it and enjoys that sensationalization.
The violence is integral to American culture, to most cultures in some ways, but it really has become intensified by our media and the way we live our lives, the movies we watch, and you see a Quentin Tarantino movie, which is solid violence. A friend of mine said, who was a Marine helicopter gunner in Nam and a writer, Wayne said to me one day, he said, the reason that Quentin Tarantino makes these violent movies is because he's probably never experienced any in his life. Mm-hmm. So, that might be true. But at any rate, Dietrich, you wanted this show, and you heard what Dan said. I think Dan is maybe, in a social perspective, is not incorrect, but you're a man who has a deep social consciousness, fights for human rights.
Was a registered conscientious objector.
Was a registered conscientious objector, but also into Brazilian jiu-jitsu and loves this form of fighting. So talk about that.
Yeah, I guess I've never seen the contradiction in my critique of war and violence in society. I never saw it contradicting the enjoyment of watching what I consider a sport, even a combat sport, where two people are willingly walking in and are fighting under a set of rules and then can submit and stop the fight at any moment. I've never seen that as the same thing as war, as usually one nation, oftentimes a much stronger nation, killing and mutilating, innocent civilians and these types of things. I've always seen this, I've always seen it completely separate and different, and have never had a problem with watching, again, you know, two willing people entering into a competition and which one gives up. And it is a physical confrontation where people are hitting and kicking each other, but right before the bell, they acknowledge each other, and right after, they usually hug. I don't see it as the kind of same thing as violence where there's hatred, abuse happening. I think it's a very different thing.
Dave Zirin, how do you weigh on this?
Oh, first of all, I got to tell you the name is Zirin. I got to tell you that just because my mom is
Zirin. I'm sorry, man. I'm sorry.
It's all good. It's all good. My mom messes it up sometimes. But before I say a word, I just want to say very clearly that the work that Dan Leibowitz does at the center is absolutely trailblazing. And everybody out there needs to check out the website and look at what the Center for Sport and Society is doing out at Northeastern University. And the second thing is that if you're hearing Dedrick Muhammad for the first time, you need to read his political writings because the cat is deep and he does some of the best work on race and class in the United States.
And you're going to hear him often on this show.
Yes, and then people know that. But I wanted to say that just for me.
Glad you did.
As a starting point for this entire discussion. Look, the idea of two people as a part of sport entering into a ring and fighting against each other is in some ways older than sport itself. I mean, it goes back into ancient China and the Shaolin monks and the idea of seeing two people, just seeing, can you break the defenses of another? And so in an interesting way, what is happening in mixed martial arts, it actually speaks to our, frankly, most fundamental urges and origins of sports at the same time. The second thing, though, is that, I mean, while what everything Dan said I agree with in terms of it reflecting the violence in U.S. society, I actually do agree with that. But we should keep in mind that boxing on a whole is a diminishing sport in the United States. And frankly, pro wrestling as well, from a ratings perspective, is a diminishing sport in the United States. And yet mixed martial arts looks like it's going to thrive. And some of that has to do with just basic issues of management in a modern media capitalist society. I mean, boxing is run terribly. There is no commissioner. There is no centralized structure. People watch HBO documentaries about boxing, and they see boxers in their 40s reduced to a near vegetative state. So it's like, I think a lot of people I talk to who used to be casual boxing fans, not hardcore, but casual, feel like by watching boxing, they're almost party to a crime for the way it mistreats fighters and the way it mistreats, frankly, just they feel like they're mistreating themselves. Mixed martial arts, particularly UFC, has a set of rules that allows for safeguards against fighters. So you feel like, okay, I'm watching something physical and I'm watching something intense, but at the end of the day, no one is going to end up a vegetable slurring their words at 45. We can't underestimate the appeal that that has to a casual fight fan.
Dan Leibowitz, how do you weigh in on that?
You know, I agree actually with a lot of the comments that both the other parties said. Dave, hello, by the way.
Oh, hello, Dan.
So, you know, because I've competed as a power lifter, as a weight lifter. I actually, you know, I'm trained in a martial art called Shorin Ryu, so I understand combat. I think that, though, that some of the popularity of this sport and the diminishing popularity of boxing has to do with our increased thirst for violence. I mean, you're in a sort of a caged setting. They have two guys that can use almost any hold, any part of their body to inflict damage on the other. And I understand the history of violence or the history of combat, and I can actually appreciate combat in its basic sense as well. But I do think that our culture is one that really thirsts for this kind of action, and that's what causes the increase in popularity of the sport. I think that we somehow get numbed to damage of people. You know, you read in the paper about kids in the city and they're getting gunned down or whatever. It's on page 52, unless it's a suburban kid. Then it's on page 1.
Right.
So we have this kind of culture in that we accept violence that isn't inflicted upon us. And we sort of have, you know, so in some ways what we do at the center, where we're totally involved in social justice issues and racial justice issues and gender equity issues, you know, it sort of seems like we as a culture like violence as long as it's not on our doorstep. And so, you know, it allows us to do a lot of things. If it's in the city, it allows a suburban white person to say things like, see, this is why I have a view of African Americans or of Latinos or of anybody who doesn't look like them. And so in some ways, we use this whole mindset where if the violence isn't upon us, we can then fit all our other isms into it and create a dynamic where we think it's fine. And so, you know, there's something about the sport that just, to me, you know, is a mirror of where we're going.
Well, and I guess I want to put in, I don't see so much that this, I agree that many of the people who fill an arena to watch UFC are out there to see blood and to see two people hurt each other and to see just raw violence. I think the kind of core MMA fan, I think, really comes at it with a different type of appreciation for it, a type of appreciation of the skill. I mean, one of the things that most fascinated me and my friends when we first watched it, you know, the first UFC one was when this 170-pound guy, Royce Gracie, was fighting these guys 6'3", 200-and-something pounds, and he would beat all of these guys with not one hit. He would just jump on top of their bodies and then at some point, somehow, at least it seemed at that time, magically make them submit. And so there wasn't like a necessarily inherent raw violence, fun spectacle violence in the very beginning. And I think a lot of the MMA core fan base is not just there just to see bloodshed, but is there to see art and skill. But you also see that in when you watch the UFC pay-per-views, if two guys aren't just punching each other right away, you see many of the drunken fans just out there booing because they don't understand what a jiu-jitsu works, blocking a jiu-jitsu hold, or these types of more fine points that MMA core fans are really into. And to this idea, I mean, this isn't really an American phenomenon. It's just because of America's place in the world, in media as well, it's become an international phenomenon even more so under the in the United States. Because, I mean, again, this has been going on for years with Vale Tudo and really with it coming a lot, having a lot to do with Brazilian jiu-jitsu, you know, since the 1920s. And so I understand some of the worst aspects of America might come out and as we watch the UFC, but the UFC and mixed martial arts, I don't really believe we can say is somehow connected to America's fascination with violence, because I really see mixed martial arts really coming out of a synthesis of different fighting styles, Brazil and Japan, and that finally has emerged in the United States and has become really only in the last 7 years a national phenomenon.
Well, let me ask the three of you this, and we're talking about mixed martial arts and why America has taken to this sport. It's such so intensely, and not just America. This sport is actually, I think, opened up, and it's a sport is different than some of the others because you see a lot of Latin Americans, a lot of Brazilians, a lot of Japanese people, and others who are Europeans who are in this little combat inside of a cage together, which makes it a little different than seeing in some other sports. But and we're talking with Dan Leibowitz, Executive Director of Sports and Society. You've just heard Didrik Mohamed, who is a mixed martial arts enthusiast, but Senior Organizer and Research Associate for the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and Dave Zirin, who is sports writer and host of Edge of Sports Radio on satellite radio. The number is 410-319-8888. You don't have to be shy. I know you love watching this stuff, so talk to us about why. Or write to us at steinershow@gmail.com, or maybe you've been in the ring yourself. Might have a nephew in Seattle who is training to be a mixed martial artist at this moment. But I wonder if what all three of you are saying is all of it is true. In other words, there's a reason why people who used to love boxing has gone downhill, or wrestled in high school. A lot of these guys who are mixed martial arts are wrestlers now. I mean, are mixed martial artists now who wrestled in high school. There's something that draws especially men, but not just men, to watching this sport. And because some of it can be really get really rugged. These guys get hurt inside that ring in a way they don't get hurt in boxing immediately. The way the blood flows.
That's an interesting point.
Yeah, there's more blood. I don't really know if people actually are getting hurt more in an MMA match than in boxing, because in boxing you're having so many punches to the head immediately. I mean, like, there is much more room with Muay Thai elbows to cut someone open, and so there's more blood flowing. That is true.
I'm not being very articulate. My job is to be articulate. I'm not being very articulate at the moment. Let me try this again. Something is happening here where it is fueled on some levels, as Dan Leibowitz said, by our lust for violence in America. Because this is a violent sport. It really is a violent sport. On the other hand, we like it. We want to watch it. We might even, if I was younger, my mentor, Al Engelman, one of my intellectual mentors in life, who grew up in a concentration camp in Uzbekistan during World War II as a kid, became a martial artist in Paris after the DP camps, and he used to love to fight. When I was young, I used to love to fight. I don't fight anymore because I'm too old to take so long to heal, but I used to love to fight too. So we both watch it. So I'm thinking about a lot of people who are on the political left, who are on a certain intellectual spectrum as well, enjoy this sport as much as a guy who is on the other end of the spectrum who might just want to throw his fist up in a bar because you love doing it on a Saturday night. There's something that draws people into this. Dave, go ahead. Is that you?
Part of it, yeah, if I could jump in here. Part of it is because with every event that UFC or other mixed martial arts organizations does, they actually disprove one of the statements by John McCain, who said in criticizing mixed martial arts that it was like cockfighting with people. Because the reality of the events is that they're very seriously regulated and that they get broken up with a quickness when someone has free shots to somebody's head. And I think what that allows for, in a very ingenious way, mm-hmm. is for a casual fan to enjoy it without feeling like they're watching the violence of pornography or a pornographic kind of violence, like something that is just beyond the pale of humanity, if you will. And I think a generation of people have grown to see that boxing, for what it does to people, and in some ways the gloves make it even worse because it allows for more contact from hand to head without people breaking their hands, is that it allows people the distance of saying, I enjoy watching the combat, but I know that other than some bumps and bruises, no one is going to be slurring their words when they hit 40, which is what people don't want to be a part of. That's the genius of what mixed martial arts is right now selling to the American public. Whether that's true or not
right.
is a kind of a different yeah. question. But that's the genius of what they're packaging right now for the consumer.
And you know, in mixed martial arts, you know, with UFC in the United States, it really is oftentimes people who've come over from boxing. I mean, Dana White was trying to be a boxing promoter and then kind of fell in love with mixed martial arts. And so like there is this connection. And I think part of the connection is that particularly, I think more progressives who are interested in the sport is that it was a sport for years. I mean, up until recently, many of the athletes, many of the fighters would be teachers during the day. And then would fight at night. I mean, they were doing this clearly, completely for the love. I mean, it wasn't too long ago that they could only fight at Native American reservations in a few places. The whole glitz and glamour, the commercialization that makes United States sports so big wasn't there that much in the UFC. And that was, you know, kind of a beauty piece for me. There wasn't a glamorizing of violence. There was just straight violence. It wasn't, to me, like wrestling is much worse in that way in that it's trying to kind of create a drama and a play.
WWF kind of wrestling.
Sorry, WWF type of wrestling. Right. But professional wrestling that kind of glamorized violence. Well, this was just kind of raw, straight, where people were really competing and it wasn't that much for the money. Now, as it gets bigger and bigger, the commercialization aspect is, you know, it's becoming bigger and bigger and it's pulling in more and more fans and you have more different types of fans, but I do think that kind of is a reason why some of these progressive people like myself are so into the sport, because it was a sport that really just kind of spoke for itself and wasn't about the money and about the glamour and about trying to portray a certain type of image. I mean, it wasn't until, I think even still today, a UFC fighter can have whatever kind of patches and things they want on their trunks.
Right.
And so, I mean, there has been some kind of clamping down on, I know Dave knows a lot about Jeff Monsoon, and he had a lot of tattoos and anarchist symbols, which they tried to put down. And they've even blurred out a young Latino fighter who had brown pride on his chest because some people saw it as being racist as such. And there's a whole racial dynamic in UFC where Floyd Mayweather said, well, white people just want to see white people dominate in a fight sport. And they can't see that in boxing anymore. And it's kind of critiqued the UFC for this. And there's a lot of different things going on, but just want to highlight, I think, again, some of the non-commercial aspect that made the UFC so interesting to watch, but I think people just coming to the sport now won't see as much of.
I'm going to go to the racial aspect of this in a moment, but Dan, let me get your thoughts before we open the phones and get Gary, our first caller, in here to respond to what you've just heard from both Dave and Diedrich.
On the racial aspect, I think, you know, when I listen to both Dave and Dietrich, what I actually think is that one of the things we do at the center outside of leadership, and we always talk about opportunity and access, and I think that Mayweather's point actually isn't correct because of what you said earlier. You know, there's a lot of fighters. I mean, Chuck Liddell got whiffed by an African-American fighter. There's a lot of Latino fighters. There's a lot of Asian fighters. I actually think the UFC, in terms of racial dynamic and in terms of combatants fighting each other and being real sportsmen about it after the fact, is one of the best things that we see coming out of the UFC. That you know, it's sort of a melting pot that works in a real visible way. You're watching it, you see it, you see the gentlemanliness of it afterwards. And so in that respect, I feel that there is a sportsmanship quality to it that's absent in a lot of other sports.
Let me open the phone to our listeners to think about mixed martial arts and your thoughts about that. We'll read some emails that have come in as well as some comments on Facebook. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Gary in Baltimore, do me a favor. Before we go to you, I just got a little note here from our producer across the glass saying that we have to go to a break. But as soon as we come back from this great break, Gary, we're going to come right to your phone call as we look at mixed martial arts, your thoughts on where it fits in our society, why it's so popular. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We're talking about the world of mixed martial arts here on the Mark Steiner Show today with Dietrich Mohammed, Senior Organizer and Research Associate.
Hi, Brown, coming together
for the
again.
For the program on inequality and the common good at the Institute for Policy Studies, and a mixed martial arts enthusiast, Dave Zirin, is sports writer and host of Edge of Sports Radio on satellite radio. Diane Leibowitz is Executive Director of Sport and Society. The number here is 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on mixed martial arts, and we'll go to the web as well as what people are saying. Gary in Baltimore is able to come right to you, and here you are.
No.
Hi, Gary. You're on the air.
Well, first of all, I wanted to give props to my man Dave Zirin, author of People's History of Sports in the United States and Welcome to the Terror Dome.
A great book.
Foreword of Welcome to the Terror Dome, if I remember correctly, is by Chuck D.
And that is correct.
And Howard Zinn, none other than Howard Zinn, gave accolades to People's History of Sports in the U.S. So that says a lot. But what I wanted to invoke here into the conversation is a movie which was very, very important to me. It spoke on many different levels. The movie Red Belt. And then also I wanted to bring in the documentary Smashing Machine. Of course, the Gracie family, awesome. And there's a part of a lyric by one of my favorite groups, Yes, and they say in this song, they say, the truth of sports is rings around you. And I may have done this myself. I'm 56 years old now. I'm a former football player, and I mean, I love it. You know, even though it's almost equivalent of, you know, I heard Zirin talking about, you know, that it's much more humane, and it is. But you know, it's still somewhat similar to the Coliseum, just much more civilized. But, you know, Mayweather is completely wrong. Anderson Silva is probably the best mixed martial artist out there. And in terms of where this fits in society, well, Malcolm X said, you know, violence is as American as apple pie.
I think that was H. Rap Brown.
It goes to our primal self. I'll just take your comments off the air and just props to all you guys. Talk to you later.
Thank you, Gary.
Well, just to come in briefly on the racial aspect, you know, you brought up, well, again, it was H. Rap Brown. It wasn't Malcolm X, who said violence is American as apple pie. But I do believe, actually, there is some truth in Floyd. I mean, Floyd Mayweather has a problem with the UFC, and there's a battle happening between the UFC and Floyd Mayweather, and Floyd Mayweather kind of seeing himself representing boxing and the UFC as being this intruder sport. So there's definitely, they're just talking trash to each other. That's a part of it. But I do think there is truth that the UFC early on was marketed very much toward a white community, and just in many of the ways they portrayed the sport with kind of like hard, heavy metal music and these types of things. I mean, the UFC started off, I think, fairly international, particularly, again, it really did come out of the Gracie Jiu-Jitsu family and coming out of Brazil. But there was a time where it was dominated pretty much by people who were doing Greco College of wrestling, and it was pretty much a white male-dominated sport. And he's right. When Quentin Rampage Jackson beat Chuck Liddell, I do believe that was a further turning point. Quentin Rampage Jackson being a mixed martial artist who used to fight in Japan, and in Japan, the kind of mixed martial arts in Japan...
Who
is African-American, right. from Tennessee, and in Japan, it's much more of a kind of professional wrestling bit to it, and they portrayed Rampage Jackson as a homeless, poor black guy that got off the street to come and fight in Japan. So, I mean, there was clearly racial aspects to what he was doing in Japan. He came over here, and I just always remember that fight because I saw video clips of this as well, where when Chuck Liddell got knocked out, and all the white fans just kind of sat down, and the one black fan in the middle stood up screaming. So there was this kind of, I think, somewhat racial tension. It is true that now you have people like Anderson Silva from Brazil, which has a very large black population, one of the most dominant fighters. You have people who are half Brazilian, half Japanese. Lyoto Machida, who's also a very dominant fighter. So it is a very multicultural sport as well, but I do believe for a while it was kind of focused more at kind of as a white male sport, but the sport has too many roots that didn't allow that to hold on too long.
Well, I guess maybe part of this as well, the racial aspect, and let me Dave Zirin and Dan Liebowitz comment on this, then come back to Dietrich Muhammad as well, is that, and this is just my gut feeling. I mean, I have nothing to document it. I haven't interviewed mixed martial arts fighters, which I'd like to do, but have not done yet. But I get the sense that there's a real mixed bag of men and now women who are in this sport. I mean, A, you do have a lot of Brazilian guys coming in from a lot of local street clubs in Brazil.
Vale Tudo tournaments have been happening for decades
in Brazil. But you've also got a lot of what I perceive to be, just looking at them and watching them, as people who... some of the white fighters, as guys who are really on the right. They remind me of guys I might have run into by accident at a bar somewhere and wish I hadn't at some point, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so I think that the racial aspect is there. There's some of that.
But can I speak to that if I could?
Is this Dave? Dave Zirin, go ahead.
Yeah, Dave Zirin here. Floyd Mayweather, let's start with there because I think it's illustrative. What makes Floyd Mayweather significant, and frankly, even an oddity, is that he is a profoundly talented African-American boxer. How many of those can you say exist now in the 21st century? Because these days, if you are an exceptional athlete, you are playing a different sport. It's like Buster Mathis Sr. said to his son, Buster Mathis Jr. Buster Mathis Jr. said, Daddy, I want to either box or play football. What should I do? And his dad said, son, please play football because nobody plays boxing. I really do feel like there is a generation of young African-American athletic talent that is foregoing boxing. And if Floyd Mayweather didn't come from a generational boxing family, he may not have gone into it either. And so we have to keep in mind when we talk about who dominates boxing today, it's Latinos and it's Eastern Europeans. So it's very different, I think, even than our conception. When we speak about race and racism and mixed martial arts or boxing, in some ways, mixed martial arts has it all over boxing when it comes to diversity, people from the global south, and even African Americans when it comes to who's pursuing the sport. And I'm telling you this from interviews I've done with African American mixed martial arts artists and just African American athletes in general.
Mm-hmm.
But you can point to, frankly, HBO. Who does these amazing documentaries about fights that took place in the 70s and 80s, and then they interview these cats today, and they're 45, and they could barely say a sentence. And young people see that, and they say, I'm not going to do that. So we got to understand that. I mean, and Floyd Mayweather, you know, God bless him. He's incredibly talented. When he's on, I do the pay-per-view buy. But for a whole generation of young African-Americans, boxing is not the sport of choice. And I don't think it ever will be again.
But I don't think mixed martial arts is the sport of choice either.
Dan Liebowitz, what are your thoughts on this?
You know, when we talk about African-Americans in sport, it may not be mixed martial arts, it may not be boxing. One of the things that we discover is that kids in the city are participating in any kind of sport about 19% mm-hmm. of the time. And kids in the suburbs are participating in about 78% of the time.
Mm.
So one of the racial dynamics of sport in general in the country right now is access. You know, it's access, it's safe haven, it's facilities, it's transportation, and it's the intersection of all those issues. I mean, if you don't have a two-parent household and you got one parent that's working two jobs, you may not know about a league, not be able to get to a league, there may not be that many sanctioned leagues, there might not be a place of safe haven to play in that league.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many inhibitors today to kids in the city for participating in interactive sport and interactive play that, you know, that they get funneled into very few sports. I mean, look at baseball. How many African-American players are playing baseball today?
7.8%, down from 27% a generation ago.
Right.
You know, so when you look at the racial aspect of sport in America, a lot of it has to do with the same things that affect us across the landscape of job opportunity or any other opportunity. You know, there's just limited opportunity for African-Americans for a number of reasons that are based largely in race and socioeconomics.
I mean, what you talked about a minute ago, and Dave, I'll turn right to you because I hear you just want to jump in, is that, I mean, when African-Americans were playing baseball, a lot of the players came from the South, and the sandlots were free. There were a field, and you played.
That's right.
When I was coming up in Baltimore on the West Side, when you in our neighborhood, which was mostly black, people either played basketball on the lot or you body punched on the lot and you practiced warrior craft. You fought.
Mm-hmm.
And so people naturally went into boxing or they went into football, which you could play hardcore football on the concrete, or you went into basketball. I mean, and those, as you were saying, Dan, the opportunities were limited. And I think that's still the case in America.
I mean, if you look at almost every city right now and you look at the state of high school athletics in most of those cities, it's very little funding. There's very, you know, baseball teams are practicing in parking lots if there is a baseball team.
So,
at our center, we're trying to get kids interested in sports beyond the sports of that they normally would go into, because there's just an array of sport out here. African Americans are underrepresented in almost every sport except basketball and football, and I think that's a travesty because the great athletic talent in the cities is being underutilized. And again, it's this whole tilted landscape that we live in, where we believe that because we have an African American president, we have some type of level racial landscape, and there's equal opportunity for all. And you know what? That's not true now. It wasn't true 50 years ago. It's not going to be true in 50 years. It's not going to be true in 100 years.
I think all of this that's being laid out also does kind of highlight why I don't think African Americans are going to be dominating in mixed martial arts, because the few mixed martial arts stars in the UFC that are African American were the kind of the oddity of the black person on the wrestling team in the wrestling high school, because that's really the only kind of high school sport that really could help give someone a base for mixed martial arts is Greco-Roman wrestling. And that is not a very strong African-American sport. And as it becomes more sophisticated with Brazilian jiu-jitsu and these, you still have boxing places in the inner cities, like throughout this country, but you don't have that many Brazilian jiu-jitsu schools, Greco-Roman wrestling schools. And so I think you're going to see this kind of continued lack of access to this also sporting opportunity. But I think the points they're making is very important about the kind of decline of opportunities for African Americans over these last decades in sports.
Dave Zirin, go ahead.
Yeah, just a couple things. First of all, that's why Dr. Harry Edwards, the sports sociologist, called the current place of African Americans in sport, or the lack of place, his metaphor is just like the canary in the mine shaft. Because what does this tell us about our country as a whole? If there's not even the basic infrastructure in our cities to support some kind of sporting environment. I mean, it's not about creating the next generation of Jim Rices. What it's about is just having some kind of stable structure for people to play. And it's like take boxing gyms even, for example. Like, I live right here in Prince George's County in Maryland. I mean, this used to be the boxing mecca. I mean, right. Sugar Ray Leonard came out of here. The number of boxing gyms that have shut down in Prince George's were basically down to just a couple of left when there used to be several dozen. I mean, this is part of the reality of what the cities are right now. An absence of industry means an absence of infrastructure, means an absence of rec centers, which means an absence of access. I mean, and then so it's like that's why Harry Edwards calls it the canary in the mineshaft, and even in the NBA as well, with the influx of European talent and with David Stern, the commissioner's desire to see, as he put it, red state appeal. In the NBA, I mean, you don't have to be, a freaking major in ethnic studies to figure out what David Stern is trying to say here, you know? But then you bring it on back to this issue of mixed martial arts, and I'd actually be curious to what Diedrich has to say about this. Is I read a book called Blood in the Ring by L. John Wortham, who's a Sports Illustrated writer about mixed martial arts. And absolutely, there's no access in the cities for young people who just want to learn Brazilian jiu-jitsu or whatnot. But there is, because Diedrich said it's not a sport of choice, but it does seem like, at least according to L. John Wortham, and, you know, so I don't know how good the book is or whatnot, it's what I read, but there does seem to be the desire of people who are, say, former high school or college wrestlers to seek it out, to make the pilgrimage to Iowa or to make the pilgrimage to the Gracie Gym and figure out how you can get access to this because they feel like it is somehow their niche. So it does seem like it is a sport of choice for people who want to pursue the very arduous, almost Spartan lifestyle that it takes to become a success in mixed martial arts.
You know, I mean, in the United States, it really has in Brazil, it's Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu that was the base of mixed martial arts in Brazil. In the United States, it really has been wrestling, which has kind of been, and Iowa is like one of the mecca of places of training.
Right. Yep.
Mecca, and you have California now because that's where one of the first Gracie gyms were, and it's close to Las Vegas where a lot of the fights occur. And, you know, the kind of the odd man out, which is in some ways the UFC completely mocked as not a real mixed martial artist until they hired him to put him on the reality show. Kimbo Slice was kind of like the epitome of what people, kind of the ignorant fan, wanted to see, of just to see somebody big and someone black just punch someone. You know, and Kimbo Slice was someone who came in to mixed martial arts by just fighting in the dock for a few $100 or maybe $1,000, and the first person to go down and not get up wins the fight. You know, that wasn't mixed martial arts. That was just kind of backyard brawling, which he was very good at, and he's tried to make a transition to mixed martial arts. But I think for some people, it's kind of helped bring forth this false reality of the idea that, you know, kind of the toughest people on the block, the people who are still most dominating in sports, are these African-American people you can just pull out of the streets and they'll just naturally dominate, instead of, you know, realizing, you know, that there's a reason why, you know, Kimbo Slice will probably never be a champion in the UFC and doesn't have the type and skill and training, but there's a way of kind of playing to that kind of racist and base instinct that's still in so much of the American thought.
I agree with that. Mark, can I chime in for a second?
Sure, is this Dan? Go ahead.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that, you know, when you get put on the cover of ESPN, the magazine, you know, that was sort of the intent, to sell that message. Here's this YouTube phenomenon, and he's going to come in. And in some ways, you know, the racial issue always plays in. And you know, Dietrich's point, the racial issue being that, you know, you have here's someone from the streets, and there's someone, it's something to fear. And that's kind of the whole dynamic that, you know, I thought was wrapped up in Kimbo Slice. And I think that UFC... you do have to be this talented, all-around, sort of wrestling-based, jiu-jitsu-based fighter that can do more than punch. I mean, there is something to the art form that's intricate in a way that you know, people try to sort of dumb down pro football players. But to learn a play and to understand the play and your position in the play and everything else, there's an awful lot of intricacy that goes into great artistic athletics.
There's no question. I want to just turn... then go back to the phone and see if people are calling in to join us to talk about mixed martial arts. You just heard Dan Leibowitz, Executive Director of Sports and Society, Dave Zirin, sports writer who wrote the book The People's History of Sport in the United States, and is host of Edge of Sports Radio on satellite radio, Diedrich Mohammed, Senior Organizer and Research Associate for the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies, and a mixed martial arts enthusiast who brought this idea for the show to my attention, and we jumped right on it. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Melissa in Glen Burnie, you're on the air.
Hi, good evening, Mark. How are you doing?
Well, doing well, thanks.
Great. I was just listening to the show, and I do enjoy your show. I listen every day on the way home from work.
Thank you.
And I'm a new fan to the mixed martial arts, and I watch UFC with my boyfriend in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to say, just by watching it at first, I was kind of taken back, like, oh, this is really violent. But then the more that I watched it, I saw that it's merely a form of competition. These people are competing. They're representing their country, their state. It's about competition. And I feel like it's something that's new, that the youth can idolize these people and say, this is a sport that maybe I could go out for. And also, I just wanted to point out that on the series that came out a couple of years ago, The Wire,
yes,
that was filmed in Baltimore, they had one of the actors go to a gym to do boxing, to fuel his anger into a sport instead of putting it out on the street and using it against his peers or bullying. And I just think that that's something new that maybe will be looked at in the future, that it's not really a violent sport. It's something that they're trying to break out into the public, gain more people, more fans, and then hopefully it'll be looked at as a serious sport and not like something that they're just brawling in a cage. You know what I mean?
That's a good point. I think that there's a – when – martial arts first became sort of getting popular in America. When I first started out in martial arts in the mid-60s, the whole philosophy with your teachers and going to the dojo was to not use this against people as a form of discipline, as a form of putting yourself together physically and spiritually. And it's, I think in some ways that's gotten lost in the love of violence and being titillated by watching two guys go at it. On the other hand, even in martial arts, that was always a part of it.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, yeah. Of watching people go down there. So interesting is someone wrote in on our Facebook page, Sandra Nick wrote in saying, I watched MMA before it was popular with my ex-boyfriend who's a karate black belt and studied Muay Thai. It's gone from being an art to little more than a, quote, ground and pound bloodfest. I don't watch it anymore.
Well, and I think ground and pound was a dominant. Ground and pound's idea of when you had big wrestlers come in, throw someone on the ground, be able to not get caught in a submission hold and just pound someone into submission. And that was a pretty dominating style. Though I think when you look at people like, again, Lyoto Machida and Anderson Silva, who managed Anderson Silva in his last fight, I think got hit once in the entire. Actually, I don't guess the fight only lasted 4 minutes, but he only got hit once, but he managed to hit the other person plenty of times. And so you see a lot more of the kind of the art coming back. But I think the kind of symbol of that is Brock Lesnar. Brock Lesnar as
the heavyweight
former professional wrestler.
Heavyweight plus,
briefly tried out for the Vikings, and you know, and it just kind of goes in, throws people's down, just beats them, and then after his UFC 100 performance, just kind of went on a kind of a tirade and yelling at people, getting very, very WWF on the crowd. And I think there was a really big pushback from the mixed martial arts community about that, because I think it showed just this type of bullying behavior. And I will say one thing I am concerned about is I don't see this so much in the cities, but in the suburbs, I've seen more and more kids say, well, let's just go fight, but not like fight, we're angry at each other, but try to mimic UFC. And just kind of, well, so let's go in the backyard and fight into submission. And I could see that getting very, very dangerous as kids just in the, you know, as kids in the backyard used to practice professional wrestling. But at least those moves were, you know, were oftentimes choreographed. Just to go out and truly fight in the backyard, I think we're going to start hearing some stories in the next few years about, you know, the savagery behind mixed martial arts and how that is affecting our youth. And particularly since it's so much of the kids in the suburbs who are doing this, I'm sure it'll get some publicity once a tragic accident occurs.
Then it will. 410-319-8888 is the number here as we look at mixed martial arts with Diedrich Muhammad, who just heard, Dave Zirin, and Dan Leibowitz. Leon, you're on the air. Leon, you're on the air.
Yes, caller, and I just wanted to make one comment.
Mm-hmm.
The martial arts historically were designed to kill people. That's what it was designed to do. There were rules introduced in order to make it safer to be a spectator sport. I mean, this is just a tad different from, you know, the I guess the Roman gladiators who used their skills to kill people. Now, to say that we're going to use mixed martial arts and have kids do the same thing that they see people do in a cage, pummeling each other, you know, into submission, I don't think that that's something we want our youth to do, given we have a culture that's predisposed to violence anyway.
That's an interesting point.
Yeah, no,
if I can jump in.
Dave, go ahead.
Well, just that my daughter's 5, and we're looking right now at trying to get her in a martial arts program, because so much about martial arts at its very core is just really, it's about confidence and self-possession. And the fact that it's become so violent, or the idea of fighting, when we think of fighting, we think of aggressors. I mean, that goes back to Dan's first point when we started this show. That's about a reflection of America in 2009, America that's rocking 3 world wars at the same time, that rewards people who look like they're pumped up on roids and ready to F somebody up. I mean, that's part of the problem. Now, but if you try to remove this idea of martial arts from the historical context, which I think sometimes you really do have to strive to do with any art, and I do believe it's called martial arts for a reason, you have to understand that it is something that we should actually try to preserve and treasure, because it is part of the human experience to figure out how you actually can defend your own body. I mean, and particularly for women, but not just for women. And it's not about being the aggressor. America is about being the aggressor. But martial arts, I would argue, at the end of the day, is really about self-possession and self-control.
Well, there are a lot of forms of martial arts that truly are more about defense than offense. You were trying to say something, Dan?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that, you know, one of the things that would be helpful is if a number of UFC athletes stood up and sort of denounced violence out of a ring.
Yeah.
You know, in the many, you know, with our program, we have this program called Mentors in Violence Prevention, where we have pro, collegiate, and Olympic athletes go around the country and talk to either collegiate athletes or pro teams or, you know, football teams, baseball teams, and the like, to talk about ways to, you know, about conflict resolution, about the avoidance of violence against women, about different prevention strategies and the like. I think that it would be extremely helpful for the UFC to take a proactive role in saying that the sport is a sport inside the ring, and that the behavior should be something that's contained inside the ring for that sort of art form. But that, you know, if we had some leadership language coming out of the UFC, I think, like, when Brock Lesnar did do that and the UFC kind of reprimanded him, that was a great thing. If they could go a step further or 2 steps further or 3 steps further and talk about how violence in general is a problem in the country, and this is sort of a containment form of that between two consensual people, mm-hmm. that would be important. Something that I think is a message that needs to be underscored over and over again.
I think that's a critically important point. I think that's, it takes us to a place where we started this conversation, and I like where we're kind of bringing it to an end here. We're not done yet. Let's go back to the phones at 410-319-8888. Christian, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I just wanted to comment. I think the violence aspect of MMA is a little bit overblown. It of course, it's a violent sport, but, you know, I don't think that MMA in the media is really going to be widely a cause of increased violence or really anything of the sort. And I would, you know, compare it to boxing. And, I mean, I don't have a lot of personal data on it, but I really don't think that boxing is the reason that there is, you know, crime in any of our communities or really anything like that. And I think that I came into the show really late, but I think that on the flip side, it would actually, having more access in the inner city areas would kind of provide more of a stable base, more of a grounding for, you know, for youth, as opposed to looking at it the other way, because really, it is a sport. You know, the martial arts are about discipline, but this is something that's, you know, put in its place, just like football or boxing. You know, there's physical aspects of it, but it's a game. It's a competition in the end. That's pretty much all I have to say.
No, thanks for those comments. I just wanted to put forward, and this is reminding me a lot of kind of conversations around rap and hip hop. I mean, and I think I come down the same way. I don't think the worst parts of rap and hip hop or the worst parts of MMA I think the worst parts of that is really a reflection of the worst parts of America, not the cause. You know, so I think, you know, some of the violent culture is played out. The violent culture of America is played out in the promotion of, you know, because originally mixed UFC was, you know, like, as real as it gets, there are no rules. It was like it was promoted as a blood sport because there's the money side of it, and they see that in American culture, that's where we can make money. And then there's the mixed martial arts side of it, where people have coming from generations of training and studying. And you know, and I do agree that just like any type of investment in the inner city, where you have programs, where you have adults, you have role models that can help youth, would be beneficial to the inner cities, because the problem is just lack of sports. It's a lack of, as Dave was talking about, a lack of structure, lack of investment, lack of opportunity for youth to express themselves, not just in physical situations, but also in art and in education and in every other way. So, yeah, I'm just kind of putting out those final points, but I really do believe the worst aspects of mixed martial arts is much more reflection of the kind of violence of this country, more than MMA is going to cause a new crime wave in this country. And I don't think any one of us really believes that.
I mean, it's interesting. I was thinking about this, going to the museum the other day, thinking about this show, and when you look at the sculptures from Greek and Roman period, especially Greek period, you see mixed martial arts. I mean, it's almost as if we reach back into the ancient roots of martial concepts and put them into this 21st century media-sized age, which could transform things. I'm not sure where this sport's going to end up.
Yeah.
Where it will finally take us in society.
Well, I mean, I think the concern is that sport's going to end up where any kind of money generating thing goes, where what will make the quickest buck, and that usually is not about that which best contributes to society and is best kind of role modeling for our youth and society as a whole.
We have a couple minutes left. I'd like to get a closing thought both from Dan and Dave.
Dan, why don't you go first?
Go ahead.
Dan, go for it, buddy.
I think that a lot of good points have been made today. I think as we started, and my thoughts were about, you know, what are we doing in terms of leadership? Where are we leading the youth of our country today? You know, are we leading them to think about healthy development, about cognitive development, about sport as a cooperative spirit as well as a competitive game? And what message is this sport putting forth? And I think that, you know, it has a body that governs it, and that body has a responsibility to come out and do the types of things that reach out to a community, that explain the sport to a community, but that use that sport as a positive tool and a positive vehicle, like all the power of sport, to move society forward, to move social justice forward, to move racial justice forward, and to do it through this great power of sport, which is really one of the only two languages kids listen to. Dietrich mentioned hip-hop. Kids listen to two languages in this world, the language of sport and the language of music. And I think it's inherent on all people involved in those two entities to move to say things and stand up for things that send a positive message.
Dan Leibowitz, Executive Director of Sport and Society, you've had the last word for today. Dave Zirin, Edge of Sports Radio. I'm sorry we couldn't get your last thought in there, man. We'll have you back, though.
And okay. Sorry, Dave. I tried to give you that opening.
Hey, man, and Dan threw me this slow pitch softball. I felt like Mark McGwire. I'm still going to have you call my kid who's still upset about that Slam article. I'm gonna track you down and give you my number so you can call him.
I'll send you all each other's numbers. You can track each other down that way. Dan, Dave, Dietrich, thank you all so much for being here. I look forward to having you all back again soon.
Thank you,
Thanks
Mark.
For having
it's privilege. Great to have you all here. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News & World Report in their annual Best Hospitals survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. And thank all of you for writing and calling in today and going to Facebook to bring your thoughts to this discussion. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Jessica Phillips and Justin Levy. We're engineered by Zachary Coleman. Our interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone. And we're looking for more interns. Just email Justin at steinershow.org to be considered. Our theme music, is by Juan Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again on podcast, any of our past shows, and hear new interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development.